Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. This video is sponsored by Ren. To learn more about what you can do to help fight climate change, stick around to the end of the video. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, we're looking at another video from the What Would You Say channel, this time asking the question, why does God care about who I sleep with? This is a question that I have asked numerous times. Often, when explaining God's mysterious ways, apologists will make use of a comparison with an ant. The ant doesn't even have the capacity to understand why humans behave the way they do. Well, let's flip this analogy for this question. How ridiculous would it be for a human to become enraged by the mating behaviors of an ant? I don't know about you guys, but I'm not going to get angry if it turns out that ants mate in a way that I don't think they should. I can't even conceive of the possibility of getting even a little upset about ant mating habits. So if God really is so far beyond human beings as to warrant this comparison, then it strains credulity to think that this same being who created all the wondrous vastness of the universe would get so mad about who people sleep with that he would then resort to torturing these people after they die as punishment for it. So let's see how they deal with this.
You're in a conversation and someone says, "The church cares too much about sex. I love God too, but I don't think he really cares about who I sleep with. He just wants me to be happy." What would you say?
Well, aside from the part about loving God, I'd probably just go with the same ant analogy that I've already done here. But also, this brings up an interesting point. God's relationship with us is supposed to be analogous to a fatherly relationship. Well, speaking as a father who loves my children very much, I can tell you that I don't care who they end up sleeping with as long as they are in happy, healthy relationships, and are quite a bit older than they are now. And that's because I love them. My ultimate goal for them is for them to have a happy, healthy, and fulfilling life. My policing their relationships based on arbitrary things like the genders of the people they are dating is not going to accomplish that goal.
Today, sexual freedom is considered an absolute.
Absolutely not. Sexual freedom definitely has restrictions. Everyone involved should be a consenting adult. Now, that said, it is a fact of life that teenagers will also be having sex. This is not ideal, but it is going to happen. With that in mind, education on the matter should be comprehensive and geared towards making sure that they are equipped to do it as safely as possible, to know their rights, and to respect other people's rights. Pretending that you can teach teenagers to just not have sex and that will actually stop them from doing it is naive at best and dangerous at worst. A 2020 meta-analysis of 3 decades of scientific research has shown that comprehensive sex education leads to the prevention of domestic violence, the development of healthier relationships, the prevention of child sex abuse, improved social and emotional learning, and other benefits. So, opposing comprehensive sex ed literally leads to some of the horrible outcomes that this video is undoubtedly going to fearmonger about in just a little bit.
We're told that nothing should threaten or constrain our sexual choices.
Again, no, we are not. Consent is the biggest and most obvious factor that should absolutely constrain our sexual choices.
That's why, in this cultural context, the historic view of Christianity that sex belongs only in the context of marriage between one man and one woman is seen as antiquated, unrealistic, and even dangerous.
Well, aside from the fact that that's not really the type of marriage that's found in the Bible, yes, insisting that it is the only socially acceptable form of a long-term intimate relationship is indeed antiquated, unrealistic, and dangerous. You see, there's the thing called minority stress, which is a real phenomenon that exists. That's what happens when someone who is part of a minority experiences stigma and discrimination. So, for example, a gay couple living in a heavily religious neighborhood filled with people who are very vocal about their opinion that marriage should only be between one man and one woman. Research has shown that minority stress in LGBTQ people is definitely a contributing factor to their higher rate of mental health disorders. Other research has shown that the simple act of legalizing gay marriage has had the impact of decreasing the numbers of LGBTQ people seeking mental health treatment, and this effect was seen regardless of the marital status of the people involved. In other words, making gay marriage legal is beneficial even to the LGBTQ population that are not in long-term or even any relationships. So, yeah, you guys insisting on the one-man, one-woman definition of marriage is demonstrably dangerous.
Does God really care about who we sleep with? The next time someone asks you that question, here are three things to remember. Number one. God cares about who we sleep with because he cares about us, and sex affects us deeply.
Well, it affects different people in different ways and to different degrees, but even if I grant you this point, it actually seems to be another point in favor of comprehensive sex education rather than acting like just don't do it is a reasonable expectation.
If God loves us as much as he says he does, it would be weird for him not to care about who we sleep with.
To an extent. Like, if one of my kids ends up in an abusive relationship, that's when I care, but that's something that can happen with or without sex, so it's only tangentially related. It's the happy and healthy part of the relationship that I actually do care about.
Sex is a big deal. A lot of people might say things like, sex is just physical and it doesn't mean anything, but that isn't true.
Well, it's not flat out not true. It's more nuanced than just true or false can encompass. Sex can be just physical and meaningless for some people in some contexts, but there are hormonal things that happen in the brain during sex that, for most people, will make it more than that. After all, we are a social species. As such, it was to our evolutionary advantage to form long-term relationships to help care for the next generation. There are other ways that this can be accomplished, but evolution is lazy, so it takes the easy route of just making the act that can result in babies also strengthen the emotional bond between the people performing the act. And of course, also because evolution is lazy, it didn't bother to differentiate between strengthening the bond between a heterosexual couple but not doing it for homosexual couples. So that's something that applies to mostly everybody. But because evolution works on variation, there is an entire spectrum of people that are affected by this to different degrees. There are some people for whom the sexual act and the emotional bond are completely separate phenomena, and there are people who could never even conceive of having sex without someone that they don't already have a strong emotional bond with, and everywhere in between.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? Ew, seriously. They squeeze the grease out of the wool and process it with chemicals, and then you eat it. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I got rid of products I didn't want anywhere near my body. I found that many multivitamins contain high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and even lacked some of the nutrients we actually needed. So what did I do? At 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. Ritual's products are made traceable, meaning we share the science and sourcing for every single ingredient. For example, our vegan vitamin D3 comes from sustainably harvested lichen in Nottingham, England, not sheep. We trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. See for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Studies show that engaging in casual sex can contribute to depression, anxiety, and other mental health problems.
Well, the main study that I find all the Christian websites are pointing to for this claim is a 2013 study that, to put it bluntly, has some issues. Now, don't get me wrong, the body of research does show that there is a bit of a correlation between lower mental health outcomes and the frequency of casual sexual activity. Well, generally, the results are somewhat inconsistent from study to study, usually but not always showing a slight link with a small effect size. But this study in particular has the strongest results, which is probably why the Christian blogs latched onto it, though it is hard to find as none of the blogs link directly to the study, instead linking to a Daily Mail article with a misleading headline about the study, but which is no longer available. I ended up finding it by looking for a later study on the same subject that had citations from 2013, the year that it was published. So, what is the problem with the study? Well, it was a one-time self-report survey from a bunch of college students. Of the nearly 4,000 students surveyed, only 11% reported having any casual sex in the time frame they were looking at. And for all the different mental health measures that they were planning on looking at individually, because such a small percentage of the respondents even reported engaging in casual sex in the first place, they combined all of the measures into one big, does this participant report having any mental health issues whatsoever, as a single yes-no. Such methodological changes during the process of the study are a huge red flag for p-hacking, that is, manipulating the data after the fact to make it show a statistically significant result rather than sticking to the original design of the study. This does not necessarily indicate that the study authors were bad actors. Often p-hacking is unintentional, but it does bring their results into question. But even so, after combining all of the mental health questions into a single yes-no, there still wasn't much of an effect, and they point out in the paper that previous robust research has found no link between mental health and casual sex. But more to the point, this study, having been a one-time survey of students, had no way to control for confounding variables, or even to determine the direction of causality. Is it that casual sex leads to bad mental health outcomes, or is it that people who struggle with mental health are more likely to engage in casual sex? Notably, research that has been done since then has pointed out that, in college-aged adults, the results are decisively indecisive, or conclusively inconclusive, if you'd prefer. But they have studied similar things in sexually active adolescents, and found a slightly stronger link, particularly in girls, between bad mental health outcomes and casual sex. It's still not enough to be entirely conclusive, but it is enough to justify comprehensive sex education in schools. Get used to hearing that, that's going to be a running theme of this video. Really, what it comes down to is that all the negative outcomes that are associated with sex can be mitigated by comprehensive sex ed, and are exacerbated by trying to tell people to just not have any sex until they are married to someone with the opposite genitals.
That suggests that there's more going on than just a physical act.
I mean, if you want to be pedantic, I could point out that based on our current understanding of how the brain works, emotional and psychological effects do appear to be based in the physical. But yeah, there is more to it than just, it feels nice physically.
In fact, the stories from victims of sexual abuse or assault, especially the long-term emotional and physical trauma, underline the reality that sex is more than just physical. When someone is sexually harmed, it's not just a body that has been attacked. A person has been violated.
Yes. Once again, underscoring the need for comprehensive sex education that includes things like consent. Will that stop all sexual assault? No, of course not. But the research is clear that it does help prevent it.
Because we all have a sense that sex is a consequential act, sexual boundaries of some kind or another are not unique to Christianity.
Didn't you say at the beginning of the video that sexual freedom is considered an absolute?
Today, sexual freedom is considered an absolute.
Don't you see how the acknowledgement that such boundaries exist for pretty much everyone undermines that statement?
The difference is seen in where those boundary lines are drawn, and the basis for drawing them where we do.
Here's the thing, though. When it comes to personal matters like relationships and how they interact with the government, I tend to take the libertarian view. It's not the government's business who I sleep with. The only time they need to know is in situations like inheritance, tax reasons, and a handful of others. So aside from a formal, this is my spouse, so I would like to grant them all the legal rights that come along with that, I don't think it's any of the government's business. As far as religion is concerned, sure, you want to believe that God doesn't like it when gay people get married? Bit weird, but fine, that's your prerogative. Nobody was going to force you into a gay marriage anyway, so go ahead and have fun with your heterosexual marriage. But legally speaking, since not everybody shares your religious views, it makes the most sense to take the more libertarian approach. Make it as minimally restrictive as possible while still protecting people that are not capable of consenting, like children. So consenting adults is the most practical place to draw the line, legally speaking, which still allows people to draw stricter lines if they so choose, for whatever reason. The problem just kind of works itself out if we start with consenting adults. If that's where we draw the line, and then I end up dating someone who draws their line at no sex until marriage, then I'm just not going to have sex with that person, because they won't consent to it.
I won't look down on someone who has a different line than me, and neither should anyone else. And again, comprehensive sex education will prepare people to deal with potential relationships where lines are drawn in different places for different people, and the importance of having open and honest conversations about these boundaries.
Many people today say that anything's okay as long as it's between consenting adults.
Yes. And the beauty of that is that if you disagree, then that means that you are not going to give consent to sex in any situation that you're not comfortable with, so you don't have to do it. If you coerce consent, it's no longer consent. So you can have your biblical marriage that isn't actually found in the Bible, if you like, and nobody will complain as long as you don't try to insist that everybody else has to also abide by your arbitrary marriage rules because you find other relationship dynamics to be icky.
Though consent is necessary, the Me Too movement has shown that consent isn't enough to protect people from harm.
Oh, there's a lot to unpack there. The Me Too movement is what happens when consent is violated. And on top of that, these violations are often ignored by third parties who could otherwise have lended assistance. If everyone were willing to respect each other's boundaries and have conversations about boundaries before getting involved, and let people know that if they are ever in a situation where they are aware that sexual assault is happening, that it is not just okay to speak up, but should be an expectation, then the Me Too movement would not have been necessary. And again, I would like to reiterate that while comprehensive sex education won't fix all of this, it will certainly help.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Consent can be confused, coerced, or even given when it's unhealthy to do so.
Well, if it's coerced, then it's not consent. And this is the whole imbalance of power thing. If you are in a position of power over someone and make a sexual advance on them, whether you realize it or not, there is always an unspoken threat that if the person with less power does not concede, then the person with more power can use their power to get back at them, whether that be prison guards and inmates, bosses and employees, or adults and children. These are all situations that automatically come with a power imbalance, and so you will often find, with good reason, rules and laws against such relationships. As to confusion, that's why people nowadays will usually use the modifier enthusiastically for the consenting adult thing. If you're confused about something, you're not likely to be very enthusiastic about it. And yes, sometimes people do get into unhealthy sexual relationships that are 100% consensual. Sometimes people make bad choices, and no amount of preaching at them is going to change that. Now, I get that this video is trying to explain why God cares rather than what the laws should be, but this is relevant because people like this will use these excuses to try and make more restrictive laws about who is allowed to sleep with whom, rather than going the evidence-based route of comprehensive sex education. Obviously, I think the best option is the one that comes with more education that empowers people to know about these situations and how to navigate them.
Christianity draws the boundary lines more carefully than that.
More restrictively, yes. More carefully, no. If they were careful, then they would line up with better outcomes. Abstinence-only education, as it turns out, leads to an increase in risky sexual behaviors among adolescents and is unsuccessful at delaying the average age of initiation of sexual activity. So by taking the naive approach and assuming that if you don't tell teenagers how to have safe sex, then they just won't have sex, you end up with teenagers that start having sex younger, engage in more risky behavior, and have higher rates of teen pregnancy. Drawing the boundary that has those results is not more careful. Quite the contrary, despite being more restrictive, it is actually the more reckless option of the two because of the downstream consequences of having adolescents go through puberty essentially having to figure out everything about sex on their own.
Number two, God cares about who we sleep with because of what He designed sex to do. Almost everywhere in our culture, especially in movies and music and TV, sex is portrayed as something to be consumed.
Well, I don't know what media you're watching, but I usually see it portrayed as something to be enjoyed by all parties involved. Well, I mean, it depends on what message the person making the media is trying to get across, but generally speaking, in the sex scenes that are supposed to be part of a healthy and loving relationship, all parties are enjoying themselves and working to make sure that their partner is enjoying themselves too.
there's a basic assumption that sexuality is about satisfying our own desires.
I'm so sorry that that has been your experience, but some of the best sex I've ever had in my life have been times when I am focused entirely on satisfying my partner's desires and not my own. And the sex I've seen portrayed in media that's supposed to be between people who care about each other is usually at least attempting to portray it as a mutually enjoyable act, though movies will often skip over even alluding to much in the way of foreplay, because as soon as there's a hint of something like oral sex, then a bunch of prudes are right there waiting to write up warnings that good Christian folks should not go see this movie. It's downright pornographic. Though for some reason the straight-to-sex with no foreplay scenes don't seem to elicit the same level of ire, although there certainly will be warnings as soon as a female nipple becomes visible. Again, not the same level of warning as when foreplay is implied, but it'll still be there.
But this directly contradicts how God designed sex to be between his image bearers. In fact, Jesus challenges the consumption view of sex, not just by addressing our behavior, but by addressing the heart.
The interesting thing about this to me is that when I was a Christian, my wife and I both read books on how to be a good Christian spouse. And do you know what was present in a lot of the women's books that was completely absent from the men's? The idea that it is your duty as a wife to provide sexual release to your husband, even if you're not in the mood. He'll just automatically be a better husband if you get him off often enough. They would stress that even if you weren't happy in the marriage, if you sexually satisfy your husband, then he is more likely to behave in a way that will make you happy. As an example, just listen to this excerpt from chapter 4 of the book The Power of a Praying Wife. Quote, "For a wife, sex comes out of affection. She doesn't want to be affectionate with a man who makes her feel angry, hurt, lonely, disappointed, overworked, unsupported, uncared for, or abandoned. But for a husband, sex is pure need. His eyes, ears, brain, and emotions get clouded if he doesn't have that release. He has trouble hearing anything his wife says or seeing what she needs when that area of his being is neglected. Wives sometimes have it backwards. They think, we can have sex after we get these other issues settled. But actually, there is a far greater chance of settling the other issues if sex comes first." That is sickening and sets up the expectation that men are supposed to consume sex that women provide for them. And this was not a minority position. There were multiple marriage books aimed at women that would make this exact point. In pretty much any Christian relationship book that we read, there would likely be a bit about how men are more sexual and more physical, and to have a happy marriage, the woman would have to learn to give the man what he needs sexually. That sort of relationship dynamic sounds downright abusive to me. It's not a huge leap to go from there to having women who think things like, if I please him sexually, he'll stop hitting me. And Jesus didn't really talk much about sex. He mostly just said the don't even think about it and divorce is bad things, both of which are unhelpful at best and leads to people trapped in loveless and sometimes abusive marriages at worst.
In Matthew 5, verses 27 and 28, Jesus says that merely obeying the letter of the law when it comes to sex is not enough. Our imagination and our intent matters as well.
Sort of. He said, "But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Which also kind of goes to show that the authors of the Bible didn't really consider women to be people with sexual desires. He also said along the same lines that being angry at someone is just as bad as actually murdering them. So we have two options here. Either Jesus was being hyperbolic and just making a point about how being cognizant of your own thoughts and trying to steer them in a healthy direction is a good idea, or else he designed most of us to have intensely strong sex drives and then decided that even thinking about sex is a crime worth the punishment of hell, which seems a bit harsh, to put it mildly. If he wanted us to not think about sex, he could have designed us to only moderately enjoy it, and what's more, he could have designed our bodies such that they won't give us the dopamine and oxytocin hit unless we do it while married instead of just every time it happens. So that way our sexual desires would tend toward wanting to be married while having sex. Sure, that's not something that would likely work if we evolved, but surely the all-knowing and all-powerful creator of the universe would be capable of designing such a system if he wanted to. My point is, this is him punishing us for having a design flaw that he's responsible for in your worldview.
It's wrong to intentionally see someone else's sexuality as something to be consumed.
Well, what if I look at a woman and think, that's a person with whom I would like to share my sexuality? I'm not interested in consuming someone else's sexuality. I want to share mine with someone who is interested in having that shared experience. Now, I'm not saying that nobody looks at it as something to be consumed. I'm just asking that if it's the consumption aspect of it that's sinful, then is it really sinful for me to think the way I do? And again, comprehensive sex education is something that encourages people to think about sex in this way, rather than seeing it as something to be consumed. So this seems like another point in its favor, and a point against the view that leads to relationship advice books being written about how men need to consume a certain amount of a woman's sexuality in order to be good to her.
Jesus clearly saw people's sexual dignity as so precious that it should never be violated.
And guess what? If we use the enthusiastically consenting adult's boundary, then we also agree that the situation that you are depicting, where a woman is fighting off a man's unwanted advances, is wrong. That is inappropriate and unacceptable behavior. She clearly does not want it, so he should not do it. Jesus has nothing to do with that.
Not even in the privacy of someone else's mind.
If the fantasy stays in your head, then it does no harm. If, however, you can't control it and can't just have it as a fantasy, then you're probably in need of mental health care, not a scolding from judgmental preachers telling you that you should be able to just stop with sheer willpower. Well, I mean, prayer too, I guess, but since prayer doesn't show any signs of actually working, that does still end up being just sheer willpower. But also, having a healthy sexual fantasy life, including the usage of porn, is correlated with a decrease in violent sexual crimes, everything from rape to child abuse. It's hard to establish a causal link because of how the data is collected, but in every instance where a country had a ban on porn, when that ban was lifted, their sexual crimes decreased. Researchers have also found that rapists tend to use less porn than your average person, which lends some credibility to the idea that the link is causal here. And in addition to all of that, despite claims by the anti-porn campaigns, men who regularly use porn tend to report that they have closer and more fulfilling relationships with the people in their lives, and that's all the people, not just their partners. Again, this isn't necessarily saying that porn makes you better at interpersonal relationships. It could just be that people who have a stronger desire for interpersonal relationships, and so will work harder on the relationships, also tend to use more porn. But as we've seen so often in this video so far, the more restrictive approach being advocated for ends up with demonstrably worse outcomes. So if you actually care about making people's lives better, you would advocate for comprehensive sex ed, in which those who choose abstinence will not be shamed for it, but encouraged to make that a carefully considered choice that aligns with their values, and celebrated for having clear values and boundaries.
In God's design, sex is instead a way that we can completely, permanently, and exclusively give ourselves to another person.
And you are welcome to do it that way if that is what you want. But I do have a question here. If sex is supposed to be exclusive and permanent, what does that mean for me? I have been widowed. Because it is exclusive and permanent, does that mean that even if I get married again, that's not okay in God's eyes? I imagine most pastors and preachers would say no, of course not. But why is it okay in this scenario and not in another? Does the chewing gum analogy not still apply to me, where I am now a used piece of chewing gum, no longer pure for whoever might end up being my next wife should I ever decide to remarry? Well, that analogy usually gets applied to girls rather than boys for some reason, but if we remove the double standard, it should still apply here. According to what the people who advocate for abstinence-only education teach their kids, I am now worth less to any potential partner than I would be if I were still a virgin. If that's not actually true, then what is different? Why do I get to have a second partner, all while you guys are teaching kids that a second partner would be a horrible thing, where you've already lost value because of your first partner? It seems entirely arbitrary, and again, it does demonstrable harm to the kids that are taught that.
In other words, Christianity sees sex as something to be given, not taken.
Well, if the Christian relationship books are to be believed, then that only really applies to women. And that actually kind of holds up if you look at all the marital relationships that are described by the Old Testament. Multiple wives whose only concern is providing children for their husband. There's a whole book in the Old Testament where Esther, a Jewish woman, wins a sex competition to become the king's wife, and then uses her feminine wiles to convince the king to stop a genocide that he was going to allow, and more than that, they turned it around and genocided those who were going to do the genociding. That is a bit of a tangent that's somewhat irrelevant, but time and time again, the Bible treats sex as though it is something that men get from women, with the women having no agency. Even in the book of erotic poetry that we find in the Bible, where the woman actually does get pleasure from the act, the couple represented there is Solomon and one of his 700 wives. It certainly seems like Solomon was doing more taking than giving in his sexual relationships, even if every encounter he ever had was as mutually enjoyable as the ones described by the Song of Songs.
and it is to be given in the context that honors the dignity, purpose, and agency of both the giver and the receiver.
I don't disagree with those statements, but I'll bet that you don't consider emotional bonding to be one of the purposes of sex. You're instead going to use that to say that homosexual couples can't have biblically approved sex because it doesn't fulfill the reproductive purpose. But even in a Christian marriage where everyone is a Christian and agrees with you wholeheartedly in everything that you are saying, I would be willing to bet that they have a lot more sex that does not end up with a new baby than sex that does. So even in, like, quiverful families, the primary purpose of sex is still emotional bonding rather than reproduction.
Which brings us to our final point. Number 3, Jesus is for you, and even his difficult directives are for your good.
It's not that it's a difficult directive, it's that it's a directive that demonstrably leads to worse outcomes in pretty much every related area. Now, maybe if the state of medicine had never advanced to the point where most STIs are curable, and even those that aren't are manageable, and things like condoms and PrEP drugs were never invented to prevent the spread of STIs, something could be said for abstinence as a method of preventing these dangerous infections, but that's not the world we live in.
Sex was God's idea. Using it differently than he intended defeats its purpose, which is why Jesus asks us not to fulfill any desire for sex outside of what it was designed for.
Well, it seems to be primarily designed to provide emotional bonding, and it does that quite well regardless of the genital combinations involved or how many previous partners everyone has had.
That can be especially difficult to remember in a culture that makes it possible to have our sexual desires met anytime we want.
Well, I've unintentionally run a bit of an experiment on that, and let me tell you, I had a lot more sex when I was living in a marriage that you would approve of than I do now when I'm open to the possibility of committing the vile act of fornication. I'm sure there are people that have an easier time of it than me, but in my experience, I could have my desires met pretty much any time I wanted when I was married, whereas now it's a big mess of, in the best of times, juggling and coordinating schedules.
But Jesus is very upfront about the fact that following him is costly for everyone.
Yeah, he was. Kind of wish that he wasn't, though. Y'all have this massive persecution complex where you seem to think that if you're not allowed to force your antiquated and dangerous beliefs about sex, to borrow your phrasing from earlier, onto people who disagree with you, then you're being persecuted. Those of us who disagree are perfectly happy to let you continue holding on to your sexual values. We just don't want you to try and impose them on us against our will, and you not being allowed to impose them on us is not us persecuting you.
Costly, but also worth it.
Okay, if you think it's worth it, great, have fun. Now leave the rest of us to properly educate our children and make sure that they are as healthy and safe as possible.
Jesus is for us. Any constraints he puts on how we live are for our benefit. Of course, if you don't believe that Jesus is who he says he is and that he is for you, then there's no reason to listen to him.
I couldn't have said it better myself. But really, in this video, you were supposed to be showing us why God would care about sex in the first place. And so far, every reason you gave why God cares about it, it turns out that it's actually healthier and leads to better outcomes in basically everything if we ignore what God says about it. Or rather, what modern Christians say God says about it, because, let's be real, an actual biblical marriage is not at all what modern Christians think of when they hear the phrase biblical marriage. Basically, a biblical marriage amounts to one man and as many women as he wants so long as he can afford to keep them. Putting that aside, modern Christians like to claim that God puts these restrictions on sex for our benefit. But when we look at the data, they are actually harmful when implemented. So this does not answer the question of why God cares about who we have sex with. It just exacerbates it. Why is God so back-asswards when it comes to sex? Shouldn't the all-knowing creator know better? And that's it for this one. Thanks to Ren for sponsoring this video. Ren is a public benefit company that makes it easy and convenient for people to calculate and offset their carbon footprint, so you can live a carbon-neutral life. Everyone is impacted by climate change. I mean, my electric bill has been higher than it's ever been before because of how hot the summer was, and current projections suggest that this past summer might be one of the coldest summers of the next 100 years. And this is a vicious cycle where electricity production puts out carbon, which warms the planet, which makes us run our air conditioners more, which puts out more carbon, etc. Well, Ren makes it possible to remove yourself from that cycle. I know that I have funded the removal of at least as much CO2 as I am responsible for emitting, thanks to Ren. So far, since I've subscribed, I have funded the offset of 5.4 tons of CO2. And that's one of the things I like about Ren. They require all of the projects that they work with to be able to specifically measure how much CO2 they take out of the atmosphere so that they can make sure that they are actually having an impact. I talked last time about the mineral weathering project in Scotland. A part of that project involved biochar, which is a pretty cool technology that I didn't really go into. Well, they also have a project specifically regarding biochar in California. To make biochar, they remove dead and flammable trees from old growth forests, which helps prevent wildfires, and then the tree biomass is turned into biochar. Ordinarily, such dead biomass would be burned into ash, which would release most of its sequestered carbon into the atmosphere. Biochar is made by heating it with a process called pyrolysis, where the wood is burned in an oxygen-limited environment, which has the effect of making it retain more of its carbon than if it just burned normally. The resulting biochar will keep carbon sequestered for several thousand years, and has the added benefit of working as a sort of fertilizer, increasing crop yields. The biochar provides a good home for nitrogen-fixing bacteria that are very beneficial to crops, as well as retaining water and water-soluble nutrients, which also has the effect of reducing leaching of the various fertilizers and pesticides used on farmland. Together, that has the impact of not only reducing water consumption by these farms, but also improving the water quality in the surrounding area. The 2019 IPCC report listed biochar as one of the top 5 natural climate change solutions. And because the amount of carbon sequestered can be determined by essentially just weighing the biochar, this makes it ideal for figuring out exactly how much carbon is being captured by the project overall. So if you'd like to offset your carbon footprint with Ren, visit the link in the description. The first 100 people to sign up through that link will have an extra 10 trees planted in their name. Today's comment of the day comes to us from everyone informing me that the dum-dum insult from Eric's Night at the Ark encounter was actually referencing a joke from Night at the Museum. Okay, I admit I never saw it, so I completely missed the reference, and I might have been less harsh in my criticism of that particular joke if I was aware that it was a reference. My bad. But hey, at least that answers the question I asked. Who was that joke for? Apparently, people have seen Night at the Museum. Thanks for watching, thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, Logan, Austin Clark, and all the rest, who are the comprehensive sex education to the adolescent that is my channel. If you'd like to teach me how to respect boundaries, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my P.O. Box address is in the description. See you next time!
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.